Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com.
Tonight we have King David giving advice to his son Solomon. David is now on his deathbed, and he seeks to be able to pass on one last word of wisdom to his son Solomon, who he has seen crowned king to be able to succeed him on the throne. Now, personally, I think this is, sometimes we're not told specifically, and like this, we're not told specifically about the time frame between chapter 1 and chapter 2, but I do believe that they're quite soon after one another. At the beginning of 1 Kings really starts with that problem that David is so old that he cannot even warm himself. His body warmth is unable to be able to warm himself, and yet we find in chapter 2, now he's on his deathbed. So I believe that this might be a matter of days, weeks, maybe months, but not a large amount of time has passed. But this is also a common practice. We see this throughout the scriptures in some aspects. You see Jacob doing this from his deathbed, speaking to his 12 sons and grandchildren. Joshua also does the same thing in the end of Joshua. So we find ourselves with David's instruction. What would King David do to be able to tell Solomon? What words of wisdom does he want to pass on? And we begin with this word of wisdom found in verses 1 to 4, the foundation of the law, the foundation of the law in verses 1 to 4. When David's time to die drew near, he commanded Solomon his son, saying, I am about to go the way of all the earth. Be strong and show yourself a man, and keep the charge of the Lord your God, walking in his way and keeping his statutes, his commandments, his rules, and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn, that the Lord may establish his word that he spoke concerning me, saying, if your sons pay close attention to their way, to walk before me in faithfulness, and all their heart, and with all their soul, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. So here we see this strong foundation. David, the man after God's own heart, is sitting here, sitting with his son, and he passes on this strong connection here. And what we see is two very strong connections here between what he says and these two very strong promises that have been given to God to his people, given by God to his people. And there's many different layers you could go down into this and unpack, but I think we'll just stay with two for this evening. But the first that we see, this strong connection that we see, is to Joshua. That as he's sitting here and he says, be strong and show yourself a man, that here it refers backwards to that promise, which we see also similar things. As I read Joshua chapter 1, verse 1 to 9, I think you'll see quite an overlap between what David is instructing and what Moses was instructing Joshua as well. Joshua chapter 1, verses 1 to 9. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, into the land that I am giving to them, to the people of Israel. Every place of the sole of your foot will tread upon, I will give to you, just as I promised to Moses. From the wilderness and this Lebanon, as far as the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, the great sea, towards the going down to the sun, shall be your territory. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you or forsake you. Be strong and courageous, and you shall cause this people to inherit the land that I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous, being careful to do according to the law of Moses, my servant commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may have good success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to what is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be frightened, and do not be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. So here I think even you can see David as he's instructing Solomon to be strong and courageous, to act like a man. Here you see this connection to Joshua. And as we see, as we go through 1 Kings, we'll also see how Solomon fulfills many of what Joshua went in to be able to do. The promise of land is really fulfilled underneath Solomon, per se. It grows underneath David, but is fulfilled underneath that time during Solomon's reign. And Joshua is here to be able to carry on the task of Moses, to replace Moses. And somewhat, Moses did great things before the Lord, a great prophet. But Joshua takes them to the next level, which fulfills God's promises that have been made before. This promise that was made to Abraham long before, when he was to walk that land after he divided the land with separated from Lot in chapter 13 and looked out on the land and saw all the fulfillment of that. Here, Joshua is the one that's going to be able to do this. It wasn't Moses that was able to do that. Moses was not allowed to enter into the promised land. He was able to see it, but not enter into it because of how he, through his anger, not speaking to the rock. But here Joshua is the one who is going to take them into this promised land. And in this short little passage, you see the promised inheritance spoken to Abraham, which is fulfilled through Joshua going in. The promised intimacy of how Joshua is there, been promised that the Lord would be with him. The promised instruction that he is not merely just to go into the land and do it and rule or overtake how he seeks. It's a fulfillment to be able to go underneath the law of Moses to be able to see this. You see, that land of where God had promised, and most importantly, God had promised this land that he might be able to dwell with them, that the presence of God is there. And you see that in this passage in 1 Kings chapter 2, that here you have this promise of God being able to fulfill his promises through sinful men. These last words are very important. Remember what continually comes up and what continually will come up, especially as we go through 1 Kings, that it's not merely that you are king and you can do whatever you want. You're a king underneath God. God is the king, and you are merely just a vice regent shepherding his people. This will come up time and time again in 1 Kings, and here David is laying the bar and explaining that merely, not that you just go and do what you want as a king, but you come as a king underneath God's kingdom, and that you're to listen to God's law. That famous passage in Deuteronomy chapter 17. When you come to the land of the Lord your God has given you, again, that promised inheritance, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then say, I will set a king over me like the other nations around me. We saw this in 1 Samuel when they didn't want Samuel's two children to be judges after him. But you may indeed set a king over you whom the Lord your God will choose, one from among your brothers, and you shall set a king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Only he who must not acquire many horses for himself or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses. Since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. When he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book, a copy of this law approved by the Levitical priests. Now, this is really important when we think about what happened in chapter 1, the essential role of the prophet, priest, and king together underneath God's anointing, that the prophets and the priests are present there together. You have the writing of the law. And although we might not see that official ceremony of him writing the law, here David is repeating to Solomon what he is meant to do, to keep the charge of the Lord your God. Walk in his ways, keeping his statutes, his commandments, his rules, his testimonies, as this is written in the law of Moses. So here he's repeating that he understands there's in the law this responsibility of the kings. And shall it be with him, and shall he read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of this law and these statutes and doing them, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers, or that he may not turn aside from the commandment, neither to the right hand or to the left, so that you may continue long in his kingdom, he and his children in Israel. So here David's first words to Solomon is, I'm going away. But the Lord is still in charge. Do you want to be a good king? Don't really listen to me. Listen to the king, the Lord God, who has anointed you, who will establish your kingdom. I'm about to go the way of all the earth. Be strong and show yourself a man. Keep the charge of the Lord your God. The focus is not, in this instance, be more like me. Actually, the focus is not the standards set by David. We'll find out they're not very good standards, right? But the standard of being a good king is God's standard, his law. You see the focus throughout this passage. It's his ways, his statutes, his commandments, his rules, his testimonies, all found in the law of Moses. He doesn't get to decide what that means. Often we might turn to the Bible and we read a verse like verse 2, be strong and show yourself a man. We see something like this and we stop reading. And we say, well, what does then it look like to be a man? What does it then look like to be strong? And we look maybe to culture to be able to help us decipher what that is. We look to heroes, whatever that might be. But here he points in and he tells him that he is to do what the law of Moses instructs him to. And that promise is then a promise to prosper. So he points back to Joshua, points back to Moses, and points back to these promises made. But also the second promise he makes, or mentions, is the promise God has specifically made to David. 2 Samuel chapter 7, we should know this very well. But he says here that the Lord may establish his word that he spoke concerning me, saying, if your sons pay close attention to their way and walk before me in faithfulness with all their heart, with all their soul, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. Again, here, focusing on their actions, what they're called to do, walk in faithfulness with heart and all their soul. Again, referring back to the law of Moses. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. But here, pointing back to 2 Samuel chapter 7, where God specifically told him that your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers. Here he is on his deathbed, about to pass away in the way of all the earth. And God says that I will raise up offspring after you, who shall come from your body. I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. When he commits iniquity, I shall discipline him with the rod of men, the stripes of men. But my steadfast love will not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. So here, David takes this and understands that this is a promise made to him which flows through Solomon. Now notice a little bit of a difference. In 1 Kings, he said, if your sons pay close attention to their way and walk before me in faithfulness with all their heart and with all their soul, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. So here he takes it to speak of the longevity of his line, where 2 Samuel specifically is talking about a son who will do this, that your throne shall be firmly established, that I will establish him, not they, not there, but him. So we see it fulfilled in Christ. Now David, through faith, understands what this looks like to some extent in a shadow. But here we're able to look at this. But he understood it that if his offspring would keep the law of God, walk before me in faithfulness with all their whole heart, soul, mind, and strength, as mentioned before in Deuteronomy chapter 6, the Shema, Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. Here, he looks back not only the promise made to Abraham, to Moses, to Joshua, but also now to himself, that he sees this continuation from this this as well. Here's a large quote from J.I. Packer, but hopefully it's helpful to be able to understand a little bit more about this passage. What matters supremely, therefore, is not, in the last analysis, the fact that I know God, but the larger fact which underlies it, that he knows me. I'm graven on the palms of his hands. I am never out of his mind. All my knowledge of him depends on how his sustained initiative in knowing me. I know him because he first knew me and continues to know me. He knows me as a friend, one who loves me. And there is no moment when his eye is off me or his attention distracted from me, and no moment, therefore, when his care falters. This is a momentous knowledge. There is unspeakable comfort in knowing that God is constantly taking knowledge of me in love and watching over me for my good. There is tremendous relief in knowing that his love is utterly realistic, based on every point of prior knowledge of the worst about me, so that no discovery now can disillusion him about me in the way I am so often disillusioned about myself and quench his determination to bless me. And here, David is able to say to Solomon, God knows the promises which is going to come. God knows that the kingdom is going to divide. God knows what is going to come, that there's going to be kings who are wicked, who are foolish, who are doing this, who are going to look like they're going to derail, right, to Jehoiada, the last king who gets deported, and David's line seems to be diminished. He knows what is going to come. But here, God is able to be able to speak through David, to be able to point back to his promises he made to David, he made to Joshua, he made to Moses, he made to Abraham, and say that through Solomon, this promise will be able to continue. And we understand that this promise is not fulfilled merely through Solomon, but this promise is fulfilled through Christ. As we study chapter 7 in depth, we saw that the kingdom will come from David's offspring, that the kingdom will be established by God, the kingdom will be built by the offspring, the kingdom will be eternal, the kingdom will be led by God's Son. We see this in chapter 7, and we know this fulfillment is coming through Christ. Here we see somewhat of a shadow of this passing. Fulfillment is found in Christ, that Christ is the offspring of David, that Christ was sent to establish God's kingdom. Christ will build his house. Christ reigns for eternity. Christ is God's Son. So his first words of encouragement, or first words, is to tell Solomon, remember the promise. Remember the promise that came through Moses, through Joshua, through Abraham. Remember the promise which he spoke to me. Keep your eyes on the Lord, on his law. But the second part of his instruction, which you find in the second half of what we'll be studying tonight, is his instruction to his son Solomon is about the wisdom of people that David encountered during his reign. We see that with Joab, the son of Zeruiah, the sons of Barzillai, the Gileadite, and Shimei, the son of Gera. We see first with Joab in verses 5 to 6. Moreover, you also know about Joab, the son of Zeruiah, did to me how he dealt with the two commanders of the armies of Israel, Abner, the son of Ner, and Amasa, the son of Jether, whom he killed, avenging in time of peace for blood that had been shed in war, and putting the blood of war on the belt around his waist and on the sandals of his feet. And therefore act according to your wisdom. But do not let his gray head go down to Sheol in peace." So here we find out, finally, David's response about Joab. We've mentioned throughout the time that Joab is a little bit unsure. It seems that sometimes he speaks wisdom. He's used by God to be able to speak wisdom, especially after Absalom. And other times it seems that he acts wisely. And then other times you question about the response. So we've looked at those in somewhat as we've gone through there. He's a hard man to understand that when kids play or when our children are talking and, well, you be the good guy, you be the bad guy. It's clear by the way that they're labeled if they're good or bad. Well, I'm a baddie or I'm a goodie. And here, David, we haven't really noticed David's response to a lot of here, but here finally David says something. Now, David has noticed what happened. He knows what Joab has done. He's very clear. Now notice also that he doesn't mention Absalom. Joab was very critical in that, but he doesn't bring up Absalom. We're not sure particularly why. Maybe David wanted to let this slide because Joab knew about Uriah, and he thought maybe he didn't want to have this information come out. But he kills Abner and Amasa in cold blood. That image is quite clear here. Avenging in the time of peace for the blood that had been shed in war. And here he's saying, in a time of peace, when we should have been rejoicing, here Joab is killing. So here's a time for war and a time for peace. So the distinctive that we see here, that principle which we've discussed at times, there's times where here Joab is murdering someone, killing someone, because it's a time of peace. Whereas David has killed many people in his life where they would have been shed in the time of war. But here that image of the blood of war on his belt, around his waist, and on the sandals, blood on the sandals of his feet. So he mentions Joab. The second group that he mentions there in verse 7, where he says, "But deal loyally with the sons of Barzillai, the Gileadite, and let them be among those who eat at your table. For with such loyalty they met me when I fled from Absalom, your brother." So we remember Barzillai, who took David food in the wilderness after fleeing from his son Absalom. Here he is. He meets him there. They meet him as they cross the Jordan. David, when he came back from fleeing from Absalom after the victory was won, returning to Jerusalem, he meets him yet again to be able to congratulate him. And David says, "Well, why don't you come back to my house and eat at my table? You have shown me loyalty. Now is my chance to be able to return that favor." But then he refused. Now, in chapter 19, we see here that Barzillai says, "Please let your servant return, that I may die in my own city near the grave of my father and my mother. But here is your servant Chittim. Let him go over with my lord the king and do to him, for him whatever seems good to you." So here he says, "Well, you take this, your servant, to return, and here's your servant Chittim." Now, I think everyone here assumes that Chittim is not merely just a person, but it is Barzillai's son. And maybe even his sons there, as in verse 7, he says, "the sons of Barzillai the Gileadite." So maybe Chittim went over, he had a family, so here's he's looked after by his whole family. So here you see that loyalty continue. Through Barzillai, and David's promise continued even after that. We notice that Saul made a promise early and didn't fulfill that promise. He broke a promise that was made long ago. And here David is continuing to fulfill that promise, as he did with Mephibosheth and Jonathan as well. And then the third group here is Shimei the son of Gera, in verses 8 and 9. But there is also with you Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjaminite, from Bahurim, who cursed me with a grievous curse that day I went to Mahanaim. But when he came down to meet me at the Jordan, I swore to him by the Lord, saying, I will not put you to death with the sword. Now therefore do not hold him guiltless, for you are a wise man, and you will know that you ought to do what you ought to do to him, and you shall bring his gray head down with blood to Sheol. So here, lastly, he gives instructions to Shimei. Now we remember here he's the opposite of Barzillai, who, as Barzillai showing loyalty to David, as David is leaving, Shimei there is showing disloyalty, cursing David. And here Abishai, Joab's brother, was standing there beside him, and he said, well, let me put him to death, with his hand on his sword in the sheath. But what happens as he returns, he asks for forgiveness, and David promises that he would not put him to death. So here, again, that instance, David does not seek to be able to take that time of war and place it into a time of peace. In all of this, we see that David tells Solomon to act in his wisdom. Again, we can't disconnect the first half from the second half. That he says, you should be a king underneath God's law, acting justly as God's law instructs you to. And here he says, act in your wisdom. But also, I think you must also notice that David is able to see something in Solomon himself. That maybe you wonder, this is why we see Adonijah not invite Solomon, that he already acts like a king because of his wisdom. That maybe David is able to see Solomon's wisdom even from a young age. That he's maybe that's why he made the promise to Bathsheba, saying that your son Solomon will sit on the throne after me. But we can't separate that, the first half from the second half of David's instruction. Be a king underneath God's law, and then act according to your wisdom, which is underneath God's law. And David's passed on his warnings to be able to tell him how to be able to reign after him. Those people who have helped him and hurt him during the time of his reign. Now we don't see at this point how Solomon reacts to this. We'll see how he deals with this later. But why didn't David take things into his own hands? Now, we can't know for sure. But I expect all of these have some form of covenant. Shimei, the sons of Barzillai, and maybe there's some form of... we don't have an understanding of a promise made to Joab. Maybe there was at some other day. Maybe we see here that all of these times that... They're somewhat personal offenses regarding David. He didn't want to seek revenge. He wanted justice, and he thought maybe if it came through his hand, it would be more revenge. Maybe he didn't feel like he could carry out this judgment. Maybe he was clouded with guilt, and he didn't feel like he was able to do this. There's many of these. Joab is kin to David, so he's uncertain of what is going to be able to happen. And so you have here Solomon about to take the throne of Israel after David. And David is passing on this instruction of how he might be able to deal with it. We'll see David, Solomon, I think, act wisely in some of these regards. We see all of this, but we'll have to see how that pans out. But we'll finish now with David's last words are gone. That's what David has done. And in three verses, we find out that, his life comes to an end in verses 10 to 12. You could go at great length to be able to go through this, but the author merely summarizes David's life. We think of David as one of the greats, maybe the great heroes of the Old Testament. You might say then, Abraham, Moses, and David would be the top three. You might put Elijah up there as well. But here, three verses, and we read that David slept with his fathers. He was buried in the city of David. And the time of David reigned over Israel was 40 years. He reigned 7 years in Hebron and 33 years in Jerusalem. So Solomon sat on the throne of David, his father, and his kingdom was firmly established. And we think all the things of David that we've met since 1 Samuel chapter 16. We think of the great heights. He was a tremendous man, accomplished great things in his life. But if you were to ask David, you know, what made you so great? Why would, you know, Samuel and other authors write about you? And we'd think about all the accomplishments. Maybe we'd think about how he defeated Goliath and decapitated him and lifted his head up. Maybe we'd think about how he acted in when the ark was coming in and he responded to that wrath poured out. And how he turned his heart to be able to respect God and his law. Maybe you would think about the length of reign. Maybe you'd think about his failures. But I think ultimately that what you need to think about is not necessarily his achievements done externally. What makes a man or a woman great in the Bible is not merely what they do, but their heart. As the first thing that we hear that is linked to David right at the very beginning, in 1 Samuel chapter 16, is that man looks at the outward appearance, but God looks at the heart. And you think about the Psalms that he wrote, and it's not about what he accomplished. Actually, it's far the opposite. Actually, when it is about what he accomplished, they're quite small and sin-driven, but it's about what God has done. What God has done through David. Again, that promise made in 2 Samuel chapter 7 is David says, I want to build you a house. And God says, no, 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 David. I am going to build you a house. I am going to make your name great. I am going to take the shepherd from the field and make him a king. And I'm going to make him rule. And through you, your bloodline, your faulty, crooked bloodline, I will establish a kingdom that will last forever. That's what makes all of these men so great, men and women in Hebrews chapter 11, is not what they accomplished, but it's about their faith. Their faith that they had in God and his promises to be able to fulfill what it was going to be. Now, wouldn't you love to hear more about what the author of Hebrews would say as he unpacks all of what Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob did, as he unpacks even Gideon, unpacks all of these, Moses. But here, all he says is, and what more shall I say? For time will fail to tell me. Well, he could say a lot more, and wouldn't it have been great to be able to hear about this? Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouth of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received their dead by resurrection. Some were tortured, refusing to accept release, so they might rise again to a better life. More could be said, and wouldn't you wish that they did? But all of these men, and particularly David, is commended not for his achievements per se, but his faith in God and his promises. They did not receive specifically what was promised at that point. That promise would be filled through Christ. That great cloud of witnesses to be able to set before us, looking to Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. And so too, as we think about maybe the last words we might be able to instruct others about, not about our achievements, the ins and outs, the tips of the trade, but about Christ and how we are to look to him.
Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com. Seven Springs Presbyterian Church began in 1874 and is a congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America located in Glade Spring, Virginia. Please join us for worship on Sunday at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. for His glory and His gospel.